From VOA, Press Conference USA, here is your host, Carol Castiel.
Welcome to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Joining me on the program is VOA Senior National Correspondent Jim Malone. Our special guest on this edition of the program is William Galston. He's the author of a new book, Anti-Pluralism, The Populist Threat to Liberal Democracy. And Bill Galston is no stranger to the VOA microphones. He has joined us several times for our debate format show, Encounter. He is senior fellow in the Governance Studies Program at the Brookings Institution, a prestigious policy group based in Washington. And Bill Galston is an expert on U.S. domestic policy, political campaigns, and elections. Previously, he served as a senior domestic policy advisor to former President Bill Clinton. Mr. Galston writes a weekly column for the Wall Street Journal and is the author of 8 books. In his most recent book, Anti-Pluralism, The Populist Threat to Liberal Democracy, Bill Galston argues that the Great Recession, institutional dysfunction, and a growing divide between urban and rural prospects, as well as failed efforts to effectively address immigration, have paved the way for a populist backlash around the world. The Brexit vote and even the election of Donald Trump in 2016 exemplify this trend. In his book, Galston underscores the role the immigration debate plays in fueling populism and argues that to deal with populism, world leaders must strive for inclusive economic growth and address social and cultural issues such as immigration and national sovereignty. And Bill Galston joins us here at the VOA Broadcast Center in Washington. Welcome to the program.
Oh, wonderful to be here.
And I'm always delighted to welcome my colleague, Jim Malone.
Nice to see you.
Well, Bill Galston, congratulations on your book. And first, let's ask you for a quick definition of populism so we know exactly what you're referring to, since it is characterized as a threat to liberal democracy.
Well, to see why populism is a threat to liberal democracy, let's just spend a minute understanding what liberal democracy is. Liberal democracy has 4 key elements. First of all, the Republican principle, the idea that all legitimate authority comes from the people. Second, the idea of citizen equality, which means that the default setting for decision-making is majoritarianism. The third component is constitutionalism, which means some institutions that distribute and limit power. And a constitution is something that's harder to change than ordinary legislation, and it's seen as coming directly from the people. And finally, a system of rights for individuals and minorities. So one problem with populism is that they buy into numbers 1 and 2, but they're really skeptical about 3 and 4. Skeptical about constitutionalism, it's seen as institutions to be manipulated, and also skeptical about a regime of rights that protects minorities against the decisions of the majority. So that's problem number 1. Here's problem number 2. Populists tend to embrace a restrictive notion of the people. There's always a line drawn between the real people on the one hand and the less real people on the other, and the less real people tend to become enemies of the people and scapegoats for whatever is going wrong in society. So those are the 2 big dangers.
Now, in the book, you fault the Great Recession of 2008-2009 and failed efforts to address immigration reform as root causes of the populist backlash we're witnessing here in the United States. And, of course, it's affecting other countries, as exemplified by Brexit. We have Marine Le Pen in France, the far-right xenophobic movement. But you do emphasize the immigration debate as paramount in the populist backlash. Why is that?
When I started thinking about populism 5 years ago, I didn't think that. When I gave pride of place to economic factors. But I tried to remain open to the evidence as I was developing my thinking, and more evidence came in that immigration was playing a larger role in the populist upsurge in more countries than I had previously understood. It turned out to be a major cause of the Brexit vote. It turned out to be the leading cause of the shift of 9% of people who voted for Barack Obama in 2012 into Donald Trump's column in 2016. And It turned out to be a huge issue in Europe, which just got bigger when Angela Merkel decided in the spring of 2015 to admit more than 1 million asylum seekers. That supercharged the rise of the AfD in Germany. It supercharged the rise of the League in Italy. It had a range of other ripple effects. And perhaps most important, it saved Viktor Orban's neck. He was in deep trouble in 2014, but he put himself at the head of the anti-immigration parade in 2015 and reinvigorated his political career and became the leader of European populism as a result. So I changed my mind about that because the evidence as I saw it forced me to. Does that mean that the economy isn't important? No, it's very important. But there, too, I've deepened my thinking. I've come to believe that the heart of the problem is the growing gap between diverse, highly educated, and growing metropolitan areas on the one hand, and stagnant or shrinking smaller towns and rural areas on the other. You see this pattern replicated in the United States, the UK, and throughout most of Europe as well.
Let me turn to my colleague Jim Malone.
I want to ask you, in terms of this focus on populism, we have seen in the last few years the rise of Donald Trump. To the surprise of many in the United States, he ultimately won the election in 2016. And to what extent is that a reflection of this upsurge in populism in the United States? And also historically in the United States, haven't we seen the yin and yang of populism rise up over the centuries from time to time in terms of political movements?
You're absolutely right, Jim. We certainly have. And so I would describe this, taking a long historical view, as a populism spike, and not our first. You know, perhaps the most famous one was the one that occurred in the 1890s. And you could say that William Jennings Bryan took over the Democratic Party in 1896 in much the same way that Donald Trump took over the Republican Party in 2016. So there are lots of historical parallels. Nor is this the first time when we've had huge national conflict over immigration policy. And just to show that the economy and concerns about immigration don't go together necessarily, in 1924, we passed the most restrictive immigration law in our nation's history in a go-go decade when people were feeling good and feeling better with every passing year until it all came crashing down in late 1929. So we have seen this before. We've gotten through it before. I'm confident that we'll get through it again, but it won't be easy.
And in terms of how President Trump is the embodiment in some ways of some form of populism, how do you look at that and then distinguish between that and his sort of own brand of, I don't know what you want to call it, Trumpism, or the aura of the personality of the man? I mean, is he sort of exploiting or taking advantage of these feelings among the countryside, as you said, the people who have sort of been left behind by the economic boom over the years? And how does he jive that with his own sort of politics of his own personality?
He very deliberately and consistently identified with the people who had been left behind. But he turned it from an economic issue into a cultural issue as well. Not only did he hit the immigration issue very hard from the beginning of his campaign to the end, if you remember his famous down the escalator announcement speech and his unique views on Mexicans, and he has a number of other classic populist features as well. Although he's a member of the elite in one sense, he rails against the elite. He also exudes contempt for expertise and basically says, my common sense is like your common sense, and our common sense is more important than what these pointy-headed bureaucrats, to quote George Wallace, and experts have to say. He has another classic populist feature as well. Populists tend to be anti-institutionalists. And so populist leaders do their very best to forge a direct personal connection between themselves and their followers. And Donald Trump has made innovative use of his Twitter account to do something that populist leaders always do, and that is to establish that connection. If you look at people like Juan Perón, you know, and his wife, Evita, they did the same thing. They didn't have Twitter, but they used every other device and every other kind of political rally and replete with symbolism of various sorts in order to forge that direct personal connection. And then, of course, Donald Trump is the first presidential performance artist we've ever had, and he's very good at it. And the sight of him coming up to a podium and doing free association for an hour and 10 minutes, it's really quite remarkable. And if it were funny, it would be stand-up comedy, but it's not funny.
Well, speaking of Mr. Trump, and as you said, his emphasis on immigration, which is one of the main themes of your book, how concerned are you about the rhetoric from Mr. Trump in particular, the denigration of Muslims, the denigration of Mexicans, sort of the scapegoating of the other, and even now policies which are designed to keep out more immigrants, which have been the foundation of our country? And we all acknowledge, and you do in your book, that there needs to be immigration reform. We all know that. And yet, it's how to get there. And I guess the question is, to what extent does the rhetoric and even the policies now being articulated, even if they have not yet been implemented, exacerbate the problem, exacerbate this populist tendency, which could undermine, in the long run, the foundations of our liberal democracy?
I'm very worried, which is why I've pushed so hard in my book and in what I've written and said subsequently for an honorable resolution to this issue as quickly as possible, because the immigration debate is poisoning our politics. And it's poisoning the politics of other countries, other Western democracies as well. This is not an issue that can be kicked down the road. It's not an issue that can be resolved by improving economic circumstances, because to some extent it's independent of economic circumstances. There's a big debate among scholars about that. I was embroiled in one just very recently at a panel at the Brookings Institution. But the evidence suggests very clearly to me that if we want to remove this poison from our system, we can't do it by attacking some other issue. We have to attack this issue head on, and I believe that there is an honorable compromise to do that, one that would be supported by a broad coalition of the American people from the center right to the center left. And it's just a question of how to get there.
You're listening to Press Conference USA on The Voice of America. Our guest is William Galston, author of the new book, Anti-Pluralism, The Populist Threat to Democracy. He's a senior fellow in the Governance Studies Program at the Brookings Institution, a think tank here in Washington. I'm Carol Castiel, along with VOA senior national correspondent Jim Malone. And this is a reminder that our PCUSA podcast is available for free download on iTunes. You can find the download by clicking on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com/PCUSA. You may also follow me on Twitter at Carol Castiel VOA or connect with us on Facebook. Here's a shout out to valued listener and Facebook fan Asad Noor from Islamabad, Pakistan. If you want to hear your name on the air, please give us some feedback on this program. Send an email to pcusa@voanews.com or like us and leave a comment on our Facebook page. And back to Jim Malone.
I wanted to pick up on what Dr. Galston was saying at the end there about sort of the need to try to find a way to settle some of these issues, especially on immigration. One thing I've wondered about, I covered Congress back in the 90s, and it was the era of Newt Gingrich and Bill Clinton, and it was a very polarized, divided time, and people were lamenting this at the time. If you fast forward now to the years we are now, some of that almost seems
quaint.
Yes. Yeah.
It's and like, harmonious.
How do we get back to that, right? It seems like it's beyond polarization in terms of our politics in some ways. It's absolutely tribal in a way. And, you know, I just wonder how that fits into this interplay of the rise of populism. Did that aid the rise of this populist sort of upsurge in the United States? Does it exacerbate the consequences? I mean, if you would talk about how that becomes intertwined.
Let me just give you one way that it does. Polarization makes it much more difficult to legislate. And there are many problems that we have that can only be resolved through legislation. There are limits to the courts, which are being stretched. There are limits to executive power, which are certainly being stretched. The Congress of the United States has become dysfunctional largely through polarization. That's fine if you're satisfied with the status quo, but if you want change, the inability of the Congress to act deeply angers you, as it has angered many people who ended up voting for President Trump. And I participated in doing a survey back in the late summer of 2016 that discovered an enormous number of Trump supporters endorsed the proposition that things have gone so wrong that we need a leader who's willing to break the rules if necessary to set them right. And Trump presented himself as a rule breaker, as a crockery destroyer, someone who had minimal respect for the way business had been done in Washington. So yeah, it is dangerous if you believe in constitutional government, institutions that have defined powers and limited powers, if you believe in the rule of law, and if you believe in fundamental democratic norms as to how people in these institutions should conduct themselves vis-a-vis one another, vis-a-vis people they disagree with. Yeah, this is a very, very troubling development, absolutely. And it is one connection between polarization and populism.
And of course, Bill, as you say, polarization makes it difficult to legislate. But it seems to me it makes it even more so when there are not agreed upon facts or a shared truth. And the reason I bring that up is because we have from certain quarters, and I must say Mr. Trump is one of them, and some in the Republican Party are talking about concern about our national security as a result of immigration of undocumented workers or so-called illegal immigrants, let alone legal immigrants. And that's a bit worrisome because, as I said earlier, and I think it's an accepted truth, this country is built upon immigrants and refugees. And that's not to say, again, that we have to accept everybody, but we have a very strong vetting system. And I guess what I'm concerned about is this type of language, the language of, you know, taking our country back as if immigrants aren't part of our culture, or somehow illegal immigrants or undocumented workers are a danger. They are the source of crime. When in fact, studies show this is simply not true, that undocumented immigrants are not the cause of increased crime. So we have facts that refute these allegations. So again, if we cannot share a set of facts, how can we come to a compromise that you advocate?
We don't share a set of facts, but we need to come to a compromise. And therefore, we're going to have to proceed through this factual disagreement in order to get there. I think there's a way of doing that. Just a few months ago, I traveled to Canada, Toronto to be precise, to give a speech. And before I went there, I studied up on the Canadian immigration system. And I found out something historically interesting. 2 decades ago, the fight about immigration in Canada was as ferocious and divisive as it has been in the United States. Then they changed their immigration system and focused more on economic contribution to the country, less on family reunification. They instituted this new system. Public support for immigration into Canada doubled. It now stands at about 2/3, despite the fact that Canadians per capita accept 3 times the rate of immigration into their country that we do. They have found a way of managing this problem. And I think we can do the same thing. I did another study last year, and I discovered to my surprise that nobody else in the world does immigration the way we do. Nobody else in the world awards 2/3 of permanent immigrant slots on the basis of family relationships. This system has been in place for more than 50 years, and I think we have to ask ourselves some questions. If somebody puts a serious proposal on the table, that will immediately focus debate where it ought to be and get the debate away from these factual disputes which cannot be resolved.
So what you're saying is that we need to reform the Immigration and Naturalization Act of 1965, which abolished discriminatory quotas that barred many immigrants outside of Northwestern Europe, but as you said, increased family-based immigration. So what you're saying is that's fine and well, but we need to modify that.
Well, yes, and we don't need to reduce the total flow of immigrants into the United States. As a matter of fact, we'd better not, because growth in our labor force would crawl to a halt if we did that. But we need to realign our immigration system in accordance with our economic needs and also with public perceptions of what we should be doing.
I want to come back a bit to this notion of populism and President Trump, and I thought occurred to me, what's more important? Is it that Donald Trump is perceived as a leader of this type of thing by some people, or that this movement was sort of bubbling up anyway, that the economic distress that maybe the elites in Washington and elsewhere have kind of overlooked for several years, they weren't paying enough attention to it, that this was kind of like an eruption of people venting about this in the 2016 election. Where do we see this going in the future? Is it very much tied to Donald Trump's success as a president?
Mr. Trump did not invent this discontent. He did not create it. He very adroitly took advantage of it. It will not go away because it is rooted in real conditions that people are living in. There are parts of the country where labor force participation is very low, where poor health is pervasive, where opioid addiction is running wild through communities, and where the life expectancy of people is going down, not up, despite all the advances that we've made in medicine and public health, in part because many of these people, until very recently, had no access to a steady stream of health care at all, but also in part because they are not living in ways that are conducive to a long life, etc. And so a couple of economists who studied this phenomenon and wrote memorably about it a couple of years ago said that many of these people were suffering from, quote, deaths of despair. So Donald Trump, in his own way, not only gave those people recognition, but gave them hope that things, but not for a better future, but to return to a better past. That's the fundamental distinction between Donald Trump and Barack Obama.
But to return to a past, that's not very realistic in the age of automation and technological advancements. And I guess what I'm trying to get at is, and I'm going to be an equal opportunity critic, criticizing both the Obama administration and now the Trump administration for failing to really address the problems of these people about whom you talk, the conditions that people are living in some parts of middle America. For example, coal is not really going to come back as much as Mr. Trump would like to say so, and it's not even healthy. So going back isn't a good idea, most people would argue, and that is what Mr. Trump is offering, and he's taking away, one could say, access to health care, which isn't very good for the life expectancy of these many people. What I'm getting at is I wonder if the economic policies that the Republican-led Congress and Mr. Trump in particular are advocating, whether it's tax reform, which mostly benefits the upper echelons and not the very people for whom they say they stand for. And I wonder if these policies are actually exacerbating the trend rather than helping them, and that's rather contradictory.
They may well be, but you can't beat something with nothing. And if you have people who have been victims for decades of employment declines in manufacturing, in mining, and the other economic bases of small town and rural life, you have to offer them a bridge to the future. Otherwise, they'll want to return to the past. It's as simple as that. And I do think that the Obama administration's very strong identification with Silicon Valley, the economy of the future, inadvertently sent the signal to the people we're talking about that they were the part of the past and that the future had no place for them. The administration was not particularly aware of their concerns and, you know, and certainly had no concrete proposals to make things better and was pushing very hard on initiatives that many of the people we're talking about thought would make their lives worse, not better. For example, you know, big new trade agreements. Now, I happen to be a supporter of the Trans-Pacific Partnership, a very strong one. But if that's all you're putting on the table, then people are going to choose nostalgia over nothing, if that's the choice they're faced with.
You can argue that trade isn't good, it's all bad for the working class, but in reality, that's not necessarily the case. And on the Trans-Pacific Partnership, one could argue the Obama administration didn't do a good enough job of talking about the advantages. But again, both political parties have not done enough to address the concerns of these working-class people, of job opportunities, of transitioning them from industries that are dying to, you know, more viable industries. So this is really the problem, and it's very unfortunate that instead of addressing the problem, that we seem to be pandering, you know, to these nostalgic sentiments, and this doesn't get us anywhere.
In a way it does. Here's why. Populists are not good at coming up with viable solutions, but they can be good at putting problems on the public agenda that have been ignored by the establishments of existing political parties for far too long. And I think the entire political system in the United States is now on notice that it has to take these problems seriously in a way that it really hasn't up to now. I think that's a good thing, and it gives the opponents of Mr. Trump an open door opportunity to walk through to a future with a program that makes sense for these people. There's a problem, though. They've been told about trade adjustment assistance and retraining for decades. They don't think it works. They don't want handouts. They want jobs with dignity and a future. And I think we're going to have to put our thinking caps on about how to reconnect the growing sections of the country to the stagnating sections of the country. And so my mantra for the economic policy of the next decade is reconnection. By the way, in the New Deal, that's very much the policy that the Roosevelt administration pursued, for example, through its rural electrification initiative, which was in part an economic program, but is in part a strategy of connecting people who were remote and felt cut off from civic and social life in the country, reconnecting them to it, or connecting them to it, in many cases for the first time. Is rural broadband the 21st century rural electrification administration? Maybe, but I think we're going to have to think beyond that as well.
And just a quick question about populism. Do you see kind of a spectrum from populism to fascism? Is there such a thing as on the populist spectrum? Where does populism leave off and fascism begin?
I think fascism is a very distinct historical phenomenon that we have to keep separate from populism. Otherwise, we'll lose analytical clarity and perhaps succumb to hysteria. And I don't think hysteria is warranted. Cautious concern, concerted action to shore up the core institutions of liberal democracy, such as a free press, such as an independent civil society, such as the rule of law, such as constitutional government. That's what we ought to be focusing on, and the fear of fascism is an excuse for not thinking seriously about where we are, in my opinion.
Bill Galston, are you relatively optimistic then that perhaps as we look toward the November midterm elections that in this case it would be the opposition party, the Democratic Party, will take note of these factors and perhaps try to come up with concrete policies to address the underlying concerns that are fueling the populist movement?
Actually, I'm not, for a reason that goes to the heart of the political structure of the United States, and that is midterm elections are rarely opportunities to forge new national agendas. That happens during the presidential nominating contest. It either happens there or not at all. And a presidential candidate can, through ideas and force of personality, reorient a major political party. We've seen it happen multiple times in our lifetime, and it needs to happen again.
And as we close, are you worried about not just U.S. democracy, but democracies around the world, particularly in Europe, that we're seeing succumbing to this populist movement? Are you worried about the viability of liberal democracy?
In some places, yes. In other places, no. If you're asking me about Hungary and Poland and Central and Eastern Europe in general, yes, I am, because historical research shows that the established democracies are much more secure than the newer democracies. Do I think that democracy will fall in Germany or France or the UK or the United States? No. We'll get through this. Who knows what will happen in Italy, but how relevant is Italian government to Italian society anyway? Opinions differ. You know, I'm not a pessimist about the United States because our resilience and capacity for reinvention is, I think, unmatched, and it goes very wide and very deep. But for the newer democracies that we thought represented the wave of the future 25 years ago, I am less optimistic.
The book is Anti-Pluralism, The Populist Threat to Liberal Democracy. The author, Bill Galston. He's senior fellow in the Governance Studies Program at the Brookings Institution. Bill Galston, thank you for coming in and sharing your insights. As always, greatly appreciate it.
It's been my pleasure.
Press Conference USA on the Voice of America was produced in Washington. Thanks to Rebecca Ward for booking our guest. Our engineer was Jonah Cummings. And joining me on the program was VOA Senior National Correspondent Jim Malone. I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Press Conference USA on the Voice of America.